Today's program has been brought to you by Heritage Foods USA, the nation's largest distributor of heritage breed pigs and turkeys. For more information, visit heritagefoodsusa.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
This is Straight from the Source on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Clay Gordon, and I've been following the chocolate world for 20 years or so, visiting chocolate makers, confectioners, cacao growers all over the world, and Straight from the Source is inspired by what it is that I have learned from them, what it is that they've taught me. Today, my guest is fellow traveler Mark Shishente from Santa Fe, New Mexico. Mark, you call yourself a chocolate historian. How did all that happen?
Hi. Hello, Kay. Clay, I'm a chocolate historian, and it happened because I happen to love chocolate, and I'm also quite fascinated by what was chocolate's history, and I was originally given an anthropological book on the history of chocolate, and that really set me off, and partly because I love drinking chocolate, and of course, you know, I just love the chocolate, and so the idea of where chocolate came from and how it was made and all the different kinds of spices really fascinated me. So I started studying.
So I took a look at your website, worldtreechocolates.com, and it says here that you've been developing historically authentic drinking chocolate recipes based on research. Now, historically accurate, I mean, how good can we be when we cast back to pre-contact, pre-Columbian times in terms of developing authentic recipes, and what might they have looked like?
Well, that's a very good question. There are actually no pre-Columbian recipes as we would consider them to be recipes. However, there's a lot of historic documentation and anthropological information about different kinds of spices and flavorings and nuts and flowers that the Mesoamericans put into their chocolate. And so when I say I develop historically accurate, I'm really meaning flavor-wise. What kind of flavors do I put in the chocolate that mimic the same kinds of flavors of the historic drinking chocolates with pre-Columbians? And that also includes finding some of the best varieties of cacao, which includes the Criollo and Trinitario, simply because those two varieties, actually Criollo was the one that the Mesoamericans were growing, and that contains really, really high flavors, a lot of flavor notes, high notes and low notes. It's now considered some of the best chocolate in the world, or makes some of the best chocolate in the world. So I try to mimic that by buying really, really good quality chocolate made from the Criollo and then the Trinitario beans, and then add various different kinds of flavors to it that mimic the same kinds of flavors that they would have been used to.
What are some of those flavors, Mark? We think of chocolate as being this thing with a lot of sugar in it, and we cast back, and we now tend to think of exotic things like chili peppers. But you know, that's ancient history. But there are some interesting flavors if you read some of the history. Things like ear flower and rosita de cacao, and of course, vanilla is native to this part of the world. What are some of those flavors? And you know, how are they combined to create something new and different? Or new to us, I suppose, different, I suppose.
Yeah, I have created something different with it, but the ear flower that you mentioned actually tastes sort of kind of like bitter black pepper, and it's was one of the highly esteemed spices for the Mesoamericans. They also had a leaf called hoja santa or cuyo, which now is only used to wrap meats and various other things, but it was originally one of those spices that they put into chocolate, and it tastes quite a bit like anise. And that was one of the great flavors that they loved. Same, like you mentioned, vanilla. They were using vanilla because it's indigenous to the area of Veracruz, Tabasco, Chiapas, and some of the Pacific Lentil of Guatemala. So they were using vanilla, and of course chilies were ubiquitous to just about everything that they ate. And then other, they had nuts. Of course they had pepitas, and actually during that time period, peanuts were already being traveling up from South America. In fact, at the contact with the Spanish, they noted that the Mexica or the Aztecs already were using peanuts and various things, and had a word for it as well. But there was also another nut. It's actually the seed of the Mami Zapota fruit, and once it's roasted, it has a flavor like bitter almonds. And, you know, really, with like any kind of chef now that has available to them a vast array of spices and flavorings, they, the Mesoamericans, and that includes the Mayans and Zapotecs and the Aztecs, you know, they had a myriad of spices as well, and, you know, lots of different kinds of combinations. And so what I've created is basically my palate. What do I think would go well together? So, for instance, there was another flower of a tree that tastes and smells like roses, even though it's not in the Rosaceae family. And so I used roses, and I put in almonds that it gives that bitter almond flavor, and then I would add, like, chipotle chili, and so I called that my rose almond drink. And it's, I try to go more simple than rather, although sometimes I would, you know, throw in the kitchen sink and see what would happen and with the flavors, and sometimes it works very well. So there's one that I made that I call Mayan spice or Mayan full spice, things like that. So a lot of the flavors I've just kind of mixed, just depending on what, you know, what I thought would taste good.
Right. And, you know, you and I had this discussion, you know, yesterday as we were leading up to this, is that, you know, the common conception of where the word chocolate comes from, you know, a Nahual word called bitter water, you know, may actually be sort of a misconception, and that if the, you know, the pre-Columbian natives in Mesoamerica were using the Criollo beans to make their beverages, mm-hmm. in fact, yeah. they might not have been bitter at all.
No, that's correct. The various varieties of Criollo that they were growing, as we know now, they're not very bitter. Of course, if you ate the seed right out of the pod without roasting it and fermenting it, then it would be bitter. But once it's made in the chocolate, you know, and has gone through the processing, it does not make a bitter chocolate. And so one of the misconceptions is that, you know, the Mesoamericans, they were drinking this chocolate, it was unsweetened or very lightly sweetened, and it was really bitter. And I'm thinking to myself, well, you know, like a lot of us aficionados, I've had Criollo and Trinitario bean, both the beans, run roasted and roasted and made into chocolate. It's not bitter, and it's very flavorful. So these drinks, I think, were really not that bitter at all. Yes, they would have been unsweetened, and so according to, you know, the
European tastes. I mean, compared with European tastes, perhaps they were bitter.
Yeah, actually, that's correct. They probably were fairly bitter because the Europeans had never tasted anything like it before. In fact, it was the very first stimulant that the Europeans encountered when they came to Mexico, you know, and they tried the chocolate. They pretty much, at first, really didn't like it, and of course it had chilies. And some of the chilies that were encountered were habanero and scotch bonnet in the Caribbean. And that, I pretty much think that that probably just blew the heads off the Spaniards. you know, very soon after contact, roughly about 1525 to 1530, the Spaniards really started liking the chocolate for a couple different reasons. And they, partly because it was very stimulating, and as well as it was very sustaining. And you know, they tended to like it spicy, and just as I use the word bitter in reference to the fact that it was pretty much not sweetened very much. You know, and what we would consider a sweet chocolate is, it would be nothing like that.
Well, also
really, really dark.
Well, also, you know, we have a different understanding about sweeteners. Obviously, people who've studied this know that one of the things that the Europeans brought with them and one of the things that they were looking for was a place to plant sugarcane. They had a huge sweet tooth.
Yeah.
But there's a sort of misconception that there were actually no honeybees in the Americas at the time of the arrival of the Spanish, and that's not quite true. But also, would they have been using agave to do something at about that time?
Yeah, they were utilizing native stingless bees down in the lowland jungles, about four semi-domesticates that they would raise. A type of honey, very, very different than the Apis variety. And they considered it to be a flavoring and a medicine. And then same with agave. They, in the highlands of Mexico, like in Oaxaca and up by Tenochtitlan, up in the highlands of the Valley of Mexico, you know, in Jalisco and areas, they were growing lots of different kinds of varieties of agave. And, of course, they were making a mildly fermented alcoholic drink, now called pulque. But they were also utilizing the sap and evaporating it and letting it get sweet on its own. However, that particular kind of sweetener was nothing like you could buy here in the stores now. It was what we buy now is really, really concentrated and really quite sweet, actually, to the taste. Theirs would have been much less sweet and much more watery. And they would, again, use it in chocolate, pretty much just as a flavoring. And they would use the honey and the agave for various other, you know, adding it to various foods like a corn-based drink or, you know, basically like a tole, which is a hot cereal. You know, so they did add it to foods to eat it, to sweeten it up. But most likely and most prevalently, they were drinking their chocolate totally unsweetened, partly because the production of making this kind of agave syrup was just really labor-intensive. And then the native stingless bees that were making the honey, they didn't make that much honey, and so it was a really high-priced commodity that was quite expensive. So, again, it was they were considered flavorings, not sweeteners, like we would just dollop a big tablespoon of tea, tablespoon of honey in our tea, you know. So,
you mentioned that honey at that time would have tasted different from what we're used to, and you also mentioned that it was, you know, easily, it's more or less spontaneously fermented, and so it didn't have much of a shelf life. But how would it have tasted different from, you know, the clover honey that we're used to having today?
Yeah, you know, there's a lot of different kinds of honey that the honeybee that we are used to can make, depending on what they're feeding off of. And the same is actually true down in Mesoamerica, where the native stingless bees, of course, you know, you think of the tropics, you think of jungles, you've got all sorts of kind of jungle flowers, a lot of things going on that they were feeding off of, different flowers. And so I've actually tasted a couple of different varieties of Trigonoma and Melipona species honey from Quintana Roo and the Yucatan and Chiapas. It is nothing like the honey we get here. It's very, very, it has a citrusy flavor to it, but it's got these spicy undertones and a lot of floral components to it. And it's like, you know, literally going into the jungle and breathing in all the smells of the humus and all the flowers and the scents that are floating through. It's really quite amazing honey. And the Mesoamericans were using this honey, like I said, as a medicine and as flavoring for foods and the chocolate.
Said it had a ritual use as well. They were using it to make effigies or something like that?
They would mix it with amaranth seeds and, you know, crushed pumpkin seeds, and they would make effigies of various gods, and they were made to be and used as offerings to the gods in representation of and as a gift going back to the gods. And so, in fact, there's a honey god. The Mayans had a honey god, and oftentimes they would make things out of the honey that they would then offer back to the honey god, you know, and it's a way of giving thanks for all these precious resources that they were utilizing for food and shelter and medicines, things like that. So yeah, they definitely were using it, and it's quite interesting.
Was cacao used the same way? In a ritualistic in terms of an offering perspective, I hadn't heard much about that.
Yes, actually, cacao and the chocolate drink. They considered chocolate to be the gift of the gods, as well as the food of the gods, and quite often they would be drinking it pretty much just in ceremonial fashion. Amongst the Maya, different Maya peoples living throughout Mesoamerica, it was pretty much just consumed by, the wealthy merchants and the warriors and the ruling elite, and the priesthood, only in ceremonial fashion. So it wasn't like, let's go down to the local coffee shop and have a hot chocolate for us commoners. It was approached in a very quiet and solemn manner, in ceremonial fashion. So chocolate was used like that, and then even the cacao pods were used. You know about all the sacrifices. A lot of the Mesoamericans practiced human sacrifice. Again, that was part of their cosmology. But oftentimes, they would actually use the cacao pod in place of a human heart. And part of that cosmology and that reason was because they considered chocolate like to be the blood of the earth. It was really sacred. Not only that, but they considered humans and human blood to be very sacred as well, because like the Southwest Pueblo and cosmology here in the U.S., they believed that they came from the underworld several times. There were like three or four different worlds that they came up from, the lower world. And so they considered humans to be sacred as well, especially with the human blood. And so there was a very deep correspondence between chocolate and human blood. And in fact, just as an example, one of the spices that they put into chocolate was actually achiote, or what we know as annatto seeds. And annatto seeds, when ground up, make a paste out of it. It makes a very intense dye that's pretty orangey and reddish orange. They would actually add that to chocolate to make the chocolate look more like human blood, because it gave it more of a reddish tint. And it was exactly for that very reason of the cosmology.
Okay. Hey, Mark, you mentioned something really interesting, which was the Puebla Indians of America. And we've been to Mesoamerica, the Mayans, and the Aztecs, and we're going to make a connection when we come back from the break, all the way back from the origins of cacao in South America, all the way up to the Puebla Indians in the southwest of the United States. So stay tuned. We'll be back in just a few minutes.
You're listening to Hologram by Snowmine on Heritage Radio Network. Like what you hear so far? Support the network and become a member. Membership helps us bring you the best food radio in the world and gives you access to thousands of dollars in discounts at the sustainably minded businesses that support us. To become a member, visit heritageradionetwork.org today.
And welcome back to Straight from the Source. I'm your host, Clay Gordon, the creator and moderator of thechocolatelife.com and author of the IACP finalist book, Discover Chocolate. My guest today is chocolate historian Mark Shishente. And before the break, we were mentioning that we're going to talk about the connection between South America, Mesoamerica, and the Puebla Indians in the southwest of the United States. Now, Mark, one of the things that's always sort of surprised me is that when when you look at the history of cacao in South America, there's no record that the seeds were ever used. It's just the pulp, and they fermented the pulp into mildly alcoholic beverages called chicha.
Yeah.
You mentioned that in Mesoamerica, they would have done the same with agave and turning it into pulque. They may have done the same thing with cacao fruit and turned it into a beer or wine, something like that.
Yeah.
But there's always the, okay, how did they discover to use the seeds? And yesterday, as we were talking, you mentioned something that I had never heard before, which is if you take unfermented dried beans and you light them and inhale the smoke, it's mildly don't do this at home, kids. We're not recommending that you do this at home. But it's mildly psychotropic, and that's something that I had never heard before.
Yeah, I actually came across that reference in a book by Alan Young, his first edition of his books, and it's really at this point more of a speculation that the beans, when they're just taken right out of the pod and dried and then used as incense, that it, in an enclosed environment, the shamans would be using it, and it was mildly psychotropic. Now, you have to understand that priesthood and the shamans, and as well as the rulers, they were all pretty much consuming quite a few different kinds of entheogens that caused that was very mind altering. Of course, they were drinking chocolate along with it. So now I've heard that about the cacao beans, and I've read it. Not only that, but I've actually had a medicine person, native medicine person from Mexico, approach me when I was doing a presentation once. And he asked me if I had any raw cacao beans. And this is, when I say raw, I mean like literally just take it out of the pod and then dried. Doesn't taste like chocolate, of course. And asked me if I had some, and I said, yes, why? And he said, well, I use them as medicine, and he wanted some, and I immediately gave him a whole handful, because for me, it's like if a medicine person approaches me and, you know, asks for, you know, would they be interested in having this? Can they have this? I'm more than happy to provide, simply because that's their tradition. And I'm quite respectful of what they require. So that's anecdotally, confirmation of that.
But we also,
quality in cacao beans, let's say.
Okay, but we also see that, you know, in South America, there are lots of stimulants which are easy to process. So we have guarana, we have mate, yerba mate, even coca. And so the need to be able to process the cocoa beans, which takes a lot of work and takes a lot of time in comparison, may not be so great. You get up into Mesoamerica, and the range of stimulants is not quite so great. But, you know, the thing which, you know, struck me, because, you know, again, you know, how do you go figure this stuff out, is that if they were burning the seeds, the dried beans, in rituals as offering for incense, that may be how they discovered that, what's that interesting aroma? And maybe if we eat it, it could be pretty cool.
Yeah, that's actually one of the speculations. But more importantly, actually, they have discovered pots where this cacao wine was being made. In other words, they were taking the fruit and they're basically throwing the whole mass into a pot and just letting it ferment on its own, which is, you know, basically the beginning stages of how you ferment cacao in the first place to get the flavors of chocolate out of it. So they were making this cacao wine. They would let the fruit turn into the liquid, and before it, it would turn into an alcohol, and then they would pull the seeds out, and basically you've just fermented the seeds. And like most traditional peoples for millennia, as long as humans have been on the planet, they literally didn't waste anything. They didn't throw anything away. So, they've got these cacao seeds, and they've been fermented. It's like, well, let's dry them and then, you know, roast them. I mean, we do that with corn. We do it with chilies. We do it with a lot of different other things. So they would roast them, and, of course, at that stage, you know, you've got, they've been fermented, they've been dried. Now they're roasted. It's like, hello, we're making chocolate.
We got some of the tastiest stuff on the planet right now.
Right. And so that's right. And so this wonderful scent comes up when they're roasting. It's like, oh, what is this? And then they peel them and grind them on the matate, which is heated, and it turns into a paste. Oh my God, what is this stuff? Right. You know, and then they taste it. It's like, oh wow, it's stimulating. It must be the food of the gods. You know, and it's a great gift.
No, absolutely. Certainly, that you know, sort of, you know, parallels my thinking about this is, you know, if you're in that environment and you're looking for calories, and you notice animals eating things and you notice all these things, if you've learned anything about preservation of food, you know you need to dry before you heat things. And so they had a whole range of techniques that they would have applied pretty much to everything in their environment in order to figure out if it was edible. But one of the things which, you know, really, really struck me as we were talking over the last about getting ready for today was this notion that, anthropologically speaking, historically, is that many people believe that there was no trade between the Mayans and the Aztecs and the Southwest, I'm going to use America, but the Southwest Indians, like the Anasazi and the Puebla Indian tribes. And yet recently you tell me there's been discovery of the residue of cacao found in places, you know, thousands of miles from where anybody believes it ever reached.
Yes, that's correct. Dr. Patricia Crown from UNM, she's an archaeologist who's been doing work at Pueblo Benito at Chaco Canyon. And through a series of conversations with some Mesoamerican ceramicists, she said, well, what are these pots used for? Because there's these very atypical cylindrical jars that, frankly, look just like Mayan drinking chocolate, drinking vessels that they were drinking chocolate out of. So she sent them off to get analyzed, sherds of these various pots that she was finding. She sent five of them back, and three of them came back positive for theobromine and caffeine, which are the two of the three chemical markers of chocolate. So, and since then, and this is actually back in 2007, 2006, 2007, she made the announcement in 2008. And since then, those sherds dated to roughly about 1000 AD. Since then, they've been finding residues of chocolate all over the Southwest from the Hohokam and the Mimbres in southern Arizona and southern New Mexico, all the way up through northern New Arizona, and even in southern Utah, and of course as far north as Chaco Canyon. In fact, they actually found stuff up by Aztec, which is up in southern Colorado. So they've been finding more evidence of chocolate being consumed throughout the Southwest through archaeological findings. And the date looks like it's been pushed back to roughly about 800 AD now, but that's not quite certain. However, it really kind of cements the relationship between Mesoamerica and the Pueblo Southwest. Now, with these dates, 800 AD, that's actually not only late up here, but it's late down in the Maya region. It's the late classic period for the Maya, and by 900, the major Maya city-states were collapsing. There was still plenty of Maya. In fact, you know, there's Maya living today throughout Mesoamerica and Central America. So it's a little unsure who is actually doing the trading. It's possible that it was the late classic Maya, but then there were a whole lot of other different kinds of peoples who were growing cacao as well as trading with it, and it was being traded up. The Huichol Indians have a tradition of cacao use, and they're in the Nayarit region of Jalisco on the Pacific coast of Mexico, and their tradition just goes back forever. And not only that, but cacao actually grows in that area. It can grow in that area because it's jungle and it's got the right microclimate, even though it's a little bit further north. So, you know, it's not sure who was actually traveling it up, but the drinking of chocolate in the Southwest is confirmed, again, in a ceremonial fashion, only by pretty much the elites in this case, because, you know, they weren't actually bringing up cacao beans. They were actually bringing up chocolate that had already been made. If they brought up cacao beans, they would have to also bring up the implements to make chocolate with it. And so far, there's been no evidence of them bringing up the implements to make chocolate. In other words, the chocolate mano and matates and the things like that, the grinding stones. And it's easier to carry chocolate, and it's because it's more condensed than it would be to carry the cacao beans themselves.
Right. And, of course, the matate and things like that, they tend to be fairly big and fairly heavy as well. So it would have required a great deal of labor and energy in order to be able to bring them up. And all of this is,
yes,
you know, 500, you know, 700 years before the arrival of Europeans in the
yes.
New World. So
yes.
we tend to think of these as very isolated communities that had no contact with each other, but it turns out that there are some very interesting connections with them and connections through chocolate. And of course, it's completely and totally coincidental that the discovery of chocolate in the southwest of what's now the United States was in a place called Chaco Canyon.
Yes, that's correct.
There's linguistically no relationship, but it's
Canyon.
But it's one of those fabulous coincidences in life. Hey, Mark, it's I noticed here in closing today that you and I both went to a place called the Evergreen State College in Olympia, Washington. I was there in the late 70s. I studied photography. You have a fabulous background in what looks like human ecology, environmental studies, holistic healing modalities, spirituality. Like me, you've got this really interesting broad background, which enables you to take a look at a subject like chocolate and look at it in ways that most people see food, and we go see anthropology and ecology and connections
right.
and all of these weird kinds of things. So it's been really fabulous to have had you here today as my guest
welcome.
To discuss all of those things. And thank you to all my listeners for being here today, taking care of. Yes, you want to say one last thing, Mark?
Oh, I just wanted to thank you very much for asking me to be on your show. I've been following it, and you've been having some great people on. So I appreciate you contacting me for that.
Well, it's been my pleasure. And again, I want to thank everyone for listening today. Also, thanks to Jack Inslee, who is my engineer, to everyone at Heritage Radio Network and to Heritage Foods USA for making it possible for me to be here to speak with you. I'm a member. If you're not, consider joining and supporting all their great work. And as always, thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes Store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.